woke up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, we're back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Rick Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 175. NASDAQ futures down 250. We were down quite a bit more a second ago. Now we're down 7. The market's pretty unsteady here after yesterday's huge sell-off. Just as a quick review of that fiasco, we were down... let me get the exact numbers here before I do it from memory. We were down 654 in the NASDAQ. That's 3.5%. That's a lot. 128, that's 2.3% in the S&P. So, yeah, it was a pretty crummy day. Our 7 big stocks took it on the chin, kind of led by, Google had the bad earnings, but then Tesla was getting clobbered pretty good. So it's been up lately, so now it's down. I don't know. But we have Professor Liu, I hear.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you? How was vacay?
It was grueling to the extent that I got back about 3 hours ago. We were supposed to catch a direct flight from Munich, Germany to Denver, and Lufthansa blew up our plan. So I ended up staying an extra day in Bucharest and then, you know, getting up at O'Dark 30 and not getting back here till O'Dark 30. So I think we figured it was about a 31-32 hour travel day, which you know, none of those are never fun.
No, I assume you were up in 1C.
No. No, back in steerage.
With the rabble?
Yeah, because this is one of these classics when we got notice that the flight had exploded, but they canceled our initial flight about 5 hours before takeoff. So we were supposed to leave Bucharest at 6 a.m. and at 1 a.m. we got a notice from Lufthansa that they had canceled our flight and, you know, reticketed us to arrive tomorrow.
Was that related to the outage?
I don't know. I mean, Europe didn't look that chaotic. I mean, after the first couple of days, so I don't know. The flight that they took out was a short hop international flight from Bucharest to Munich. So it was a flight going into their feeder. They didn't take out the main international flight, and I don't really know what the rationale was. It just, you know, five hours from the time you're supposed to take off, they cancel and then say, oh, by the way, you're going to leave 3 days from now. Good luck with hotel and you know, everything else.
So they have somewhat of a hub and spoke kind of thing over there too.
Yeah, right. So Munich is, for Lufthansa, Munich is a hub. We ended up flying out on LOT Airlines, the Polish carrier.
Ah.
So instead of going through Munich, we went through Warsaw.
So what kind of plane was this? This was one of DC-3, was it?
Yeah, really. No, I mean we flew home across the pond on a 787, a Dreamliner, and so it was, you know, it was fine. We weren't using any. We ended up coming back here to Denver on JetBlue, which I had never flown before, and I did not realize the kind of operation JetBlue has in New York. But
yeah,
I mean, they're huge.
They're kind of a remember People's Express. They're sort of the same sort of deal. Who else was real big there and went out of business? They flew out of there everywhere. for cheap. It was after People Express. God, what's the name of those guys? They've been out of business now for a while.
Yeah, well, these guys, I mean, you can, if you look at their schedule, they've got a whole, basically a whole terminal at JFK. Excuse me, my voice is a little
rough. You were JFK. I'm thinking the guys I was talking about, they were in Newark, was People's, and there was somebody after them. Greg, you're way too young for this. People's Express, now everybody's going to say this chief is really off his rocker this morning. You went on the plane without a ticket.
Yeah.
And then you sat there, and they came down the aisle with a cash register. And you could pay by credit card, or you could pay by cash, or if you had quarters. And it was like $60 to go from, you know, somewhere to somewhere. And you could pull out, you know, a couple of ones and a few tens and some quarters, and there you were good to go. What was the deal, Lou, if you didn't have any money, though? They couldn't exactly toss you off. You're already up in the air.
I don't know how the business model dealt with that. I recall it not being much of a problem.
No, I don't think it was either. It was a different world. I mean, it was nobody blew up planes and nobody did all that stuff. There was no TSA.
JetBlue has just a ton of resources there, and of course they are. If you, as I said, watching the board at JFK, they're going everywhere. You know, everywhere in the East Coast. A few transcontinental flights, but they short hop from New York. They short hop to all over the place. So anyway, very comfortable plane, no first class on the aircraft.
That's when you walk up and say, "Don't you know who I am?" Speaking of which, did you see the?
What if they ask for pilots? Do you step up if they say,
no.
"Hey, we're looking for pilots"?
No, I don't. I don't step up and do. One thing you learn in the military is you don't volunteer for anything.
Now, what if it was in the movie when the guys got sick on the chicken or the fish or whatever it was? Would you have to step up?
I can make funny jokes. I mean, that's that's pretty easy. But no, it was a long day yesterday, and I'm happy to be back. The trip itself was, you know, through Eastern. I was in Eastern Europe and traveling from. Vienna to the Black Sea, and really, really interesting.
Like on a canal or
the Danube.
Oh, so you did the river. I've heard those things are spectacular. Are they?
I'm not sure. You know, spectacular is the word. Fascinating, interesting, not necessarily relaxing because you're, you're not. There's no day where you really just sort of sit on the boat and roll down the river. You're out every day. So, you know,
idea? That every night you pull in.
Yeah, because the river, you know, you're right there. The boat docks right at the downtown of whatever city you're visiting, and you just walk off the boat. And there was the occasional bus ride, but a lot of it, you know, I mean, we stopped in the capital of the Slovak Republic, Bratislava. And, you know, you get off the boat docks, you walk off the boat, and you're right there in the old downtown. So
one guy did one of those things that everybody had their own bike. So every time you landed, you took off on your bike.
There are some cruise lines that give you that option. We did bike out of Vienna and went down the Danube. And, you know, the Danube is an old river, so it's been rechanneled and canaled and a bunch of other stuff. But we took bikes one day, mostly though it was walking, and I think we tallied it at the end. I don't think there was a day where the temperature was less than 90.
Really?
When we were out, and a lot of days where we were, you know, between 98 and 104 walking around. So
well, allegedly the other day was who knows how long they've been keeping planetary numbers. Sunday was the hottest day ever on the planet, and Monday was hotter, according to...
I'm sure that's wrong.
Why? You know,
well, because when I flew over Greenland, it still had ice on it.
Well, the hottest day that people have been keeping track, the average temperature worldwide was like 60.2 or something, and the record before was 60.109 or something.
I don't trust any of that stuff and those numbers and the history and all that. But in any event,
I just said that.
It was certainly warm. Big heat dome in Eastern Europe.
Lou, it was the Copernicus Institute. What did Copernicus do? I remember him. He did something. Why am I
wrong? Copernicus is the Copernican theory is that the Earth revolves around the Sun.
Okay. I knew he was one of those guys.
Pretty basic. Yeah, well, they were going to burn him at the stake.
Yeah, well,
if I remember right, for disclosing that.
It had to be tough being burned at the stake. By the way, funny you should mention the first class thing, because Southwest profits.
No, you're thinking Galileo. Copernicus, I think, was okay.
Oh, no, they went after Copernicus.
Yeah, they went after all those guys.
Galileo actually changed his mind.
Well, he was encouraged to change his mind by the right. by the church.
God. Well, Southwest has decided they're going to take urgent steps to increase revenue, so they're going to be able to. They're going to have assigned seating now. They're going to offer extra leg room in some of the planes to try and get some travelers back. Because evidently, even though the summer is busy, they have revenues down on some of these tickets. Plus, they're going to sue Boeing, I think, Lou, because they have had the only, for those that don't know, Southwest has been 737 only since really the day they started, right? And they've never bought an Airbus plane. And I think they are pissed at Boeing because they're only going to get 20 deliveries this year instead of 40. And I think their shtick was every pilot could show up with every plane and just take off. I don't think you can do that with the MAX versus like a 400, can you?
Well, we found out after the MAX came out and we had those two crashes that if you weren't properly trained and didn't understand how the systems worked on the MAX, you could crash the aircraft. So I think the answer to that is no. You can't just waltz over one to the other.
But you used to be able to do it on the 300s, 400s, and 200s, right?
I think that's right. The thing that got them in trouble on the MAX was, if I remember right, when they were in autopilot, you would get a counter indication for certain control inputs,
but it really was a totally new aircraft that they hided under the 737 name. I mean, the wings were different, the height was different, everything's different.
Yeah, the height was different, definitely different. Yeah.
So yeah. Hey, all kinds of stuff going on. Yesterday, the big news was the shooter in the Trump deal had Googled how far away was Oswald when he shot Kennedy. I don't know if you saw that one yesterday.
It was pretty funny. I take a 2-week absence from the show and pretty much nothing happens. We have nothing to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
The issue with the shooting and the attempted assassination to me is fascinating because it's so revelatory of all kinds of issues with our press, with our government institutions, I don't like to think of myself as a conspiracy guy who defaults to aha, somebody meant for this to happen.
I typed it in, guys. Sorry, I messed up your Google searches. You're probably now on the list. The answer from the government and the Warren Commission is 265.3 feet.
There you go.
Not even 100 yards.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty close.
Well, with a high-powered scope and a guy who had trained as a Marine sharpshooter, no. And even if the target was moving, it wasn't moving that fast. I've been to the depository, the Texas Books Depository building, and looked out the window with my first reaction when I looked out the window was, I could probably make the shot. I mean, I don't know if I could shoot as quickly with a bolt action rifle as Oswald did, but again, he was trained. But with a scope on a slow moving target like that, it's not that hard a shot.
Well, so you were saying that, what we were doing, kind of not to change this, we're not changing the subject at all, is when we were walking through this a couple of days after it happened, and I was talking to Kevin and Carl and everybody, and it is really sort of, I don't know what the, I use the term protocol interesting, but as a service guy, it's like, how many people, how do you even plan something like this when somebody goes, okay, we're going to have this is somewhat like a county fairgrounds, right, for lack of a better term. I mean, we're going to have this many people and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so we're going to vet the people that are inside. And now somebody has to say, this particular grounds is going to take, we kind of went over this a little bit, but I'll review it some, is going to take us 20 Secret Service guys or 15 or somebody has to make that call. And then somebody has to say, okay, we need X number of local Leos to do the outside and handle traffic and all the other stuff. Somebody's got to make that call. And then somebody has to say, well, geez, the county, you said you wanted 30, and the county's only got 20. Okay, we need to get over guys from the state overtime. Now, who pays for that? I mean, this is everybody who just watches this crap on TV, or not crap, I mean, it was an assassination attempt, is an immediate expert. And all I keep thinking of is how many variables there are on this, and who does what where, and what if you can't get the 10 from the state? Does the, and I'm not blaming the Trump people at all, but does the SEC turn around to the Trump guy and say, hey, look, we think we need 30 people outside, and all we can find is 20, even though we're paying overtime. Maybe we should cancel this thing. Well, that's going to go over like a fart in church. So, I mean, you wonder how does somebody make all this happen in a way that everything flows smoothly, and whose judgments are there in terms of how many people and where they? I mean, I know they're trained in all that stuff, but it still seems. My question was, okay, Robert Kennedy Jr. just got protection. What does that mean? Does he have one person, and the next day he wants a whole rally in, you know, Daly Plaza, not the one in Dallas, the one here, and they need all of a sudden 50 people. Are they available? Who gets them? Who pays for them? There's way more to this than kind of meets the eye, I think.
Well, if what you're trying to say is that it's a complex process, the answer to that, of course, is yes. But that's what these guys do. And again, this was not a failure. The point I was making was, I hate to think of myself as a conspiracy theorist, but when you look at the missteps here, there are so many that your initial reaction is, this cannot be the result of incompetence in a professional organization. If it's this incompetent, then we have much bigger problems. That's the mindset.
Well, we've seen that everywhere in his competency. Everywhere up in local, state, federal. It seems these people.
And so go back to your question. Yes, it's a complex issue, but this was not the result of a complex issue. This was the result of either some kind of conspiracy where they knew, or they, you know, and we may never, again, because of the way the FBI has handled itself in the last, you know, 10 years, we may never get an answer, and I wouldn't trust the answer coming out of the FBI anyway. But you have a situation where some kid, 20 years old, with just out of the blue, decides I'm going to shoot the leading candidate for the, you know, for the presidency. He doesn't do anything special. He does some basic stuff. He takes his DJ-3 drone, which you can buy. I've got one, which you can buy off the shelf. Flies it over the grounds several times, including the day of the shooting. Nobody notices. He surveils the area. We haven't heard where he put the gun. He obviously stashed the gun, pre-stashes the gun there, and apparently a ladder. Comes in through the checkpoint. He's carrying a rangefinder that nobody says, well, this is kind of a weird thing to have here. I wonder what he needs that for. You know, again, now, having said that, hindsight's always 20/20, but there were, and then the whole sequence of him climbing up on a roof that is, you know, 150 yards from where
it's the building. It's the building the police were staging in.
Exactly. He climbs up on the roof of that, you know, and it took what, 10 minutes from the time people start calling and saying, there's a shooter, you've got a potential shooter on the roof. You know, and they don't stop the president from going out. There are so many miscues.
Well,
it's
one of the things Carl was talking about, Lou. I mean, obviously, you're in Europe. He said there's no way that your local Leos or your state and the Secret Service can communicate with each other. I mean, on a regular radio. He said, because now everybody's going with this encrypted stuff. He says, you literally have to, and he says, but people do this, it's easy enough to do. You have to have a police guy sitting across the table from a Secret Service guy so they can go
single
back.
Single point of contact.
You know, I didn't.
But I mean, my point is to believe that all of this coincidentally happened with an untrained guy who says, you know what, I'm going to a presidential rally. I come in through the initial screen. I get picked up, detected with a rangefinder. I'm picked up looking at the building and climbing up on it. Nobody gets word out fast enough, you know, and I'm spotted with a gun, and nobody gets word out fast enough, not just to intercept him, but to stop Trump from speaking.
Yeah, that's, well, you know, I sent everybody, I don't know if I sent it to you.
And they just, what was it, 2 days ago, they issued a request to the Trump campaign not to do any more outdoor rallies. So they're not afraid to tell him, don't do this anymore.
Well, now they aren't, but, you know, the thing is kind of, I don't know if I sent it to you, Lou. If you probably seen it. I sent the movie, the part in the movie, the Day of the Jackal, when they hired the guy.
Yeah.
And there's, I think there's a nuance here in terms of the Secret Service and the FBI. I mean, I'm not about to say that they did this right. I mean, I'm not going to do that because I think they didn't. There's a massive difference between the lone guy who wants to get out alive and the lone guy who doesn't care in terms of how dangerous they are. This guy didn't care if he died.
We're not talking about the Jackal.
That's what I'm saying, but the reason why the Jackal went through all that preparation is he wanted to get out of there.
Well, he did, but this guy doesn't care.
That's what I'm saying. That's really tough.
It is tough. But again, this is not the case of a suicide bomber or something like that. This was so eminently preventable and easily identified. I'm willing to go with nobody.
It's easy. I mean,
nobody spots a kid. He gets up there. Nobody can prevent the kid from getting up there with a rifle, which sounds just crazy. What is unbelievable to me is that there was no mechanism in place for a 911 call or some other emergency call to immediately get routed to stop this guy from, or stop Trump from walking
out. How many more people? I see this kid. I don't know, I shouldn't, but I see him very similar to the kid who did all the Highland Park stuff. Some 20-year-old locked up in his basement. Nobody knows what the hell he's doing. Doesn't talk to anybody. Doesn't like anybody. Doesn't have any friends. This kid at least doesn't seem to be on the internet as much as the Highland Park kid was. Kid looks weird. Not that that's, you know, a mental thing. And somehow or another happens to have a dad with 90 bazillion guns. They're both the exact same modus operandi. I guess my question is, how many more of these guys are there, or maybe even girls, across this country after COVID and everything? Don't talk to anybody. Don't know what they're doing. Well, by the way, they're sitting next to an arsenal. We got like 100 of them, 1,000 of them, 2,000 of them. I mean, it scares the bejesus out of me, to be honest with you.
Well, I that's, you know, that lone shooter situation is probably the most difficult to assess and to identify and predict. And it's one of the reasons why, although I think they're probably unconstitutional, I'm very torn about red flag laws, which allow the kind of response that I think you need in a situation like this, where you have some guy who, you know, suddenly goes, who has some danger signs, but isn't quite there yet. And so you have a mechanism in place where you can remove access to firearms from that person.
Well, but it seems, why do they always seem to have a dad? How do parents not recognize their kids?
Well, they don't always. I mean, the shooter, the Sandy Hook shooter, was his single parent. You know, in fact, he murdered, the first person he killed was his mother.
That's always a good start. There you go.
And so I'm not sure you can draw a parallel. This kid was not the crazy loner that we've seen in some of these other mass shootings or assassinations. He was very focused. He was very deliberate, very direct. He did the research. He got the gun. He planned it all out. He knew where, he had the rangefinder. I mean, this is not this. He's not a disorganized. The terms,
but how would it? They showed pictures of the kid in high school, and he's always all eating by himself and everything. I mean, man, I see people walking down the block here with their friends, and they're not even talking to their friends. They're looking on their phone. I mean, it's just different than the way we were brought up. I mean, you know, I don't know if it's dangerous or not, or it's just different or what.
It's an easy target for the CIA to kind of flip.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Or somebody else.
Lou, how about bringing us up to speed since we haven't been here? Ukraine, Red Sea, off the front page. Something's still going on there, obviously. What's the deal?
Really. So, part of the trip was spent in Romania, and you know, I was in the last couple of days, an extra day in Bucharest, and a full day in a place called Constanta, which is on the coast.
Is Bucharest as beautiful as they say?
I'm sorry.
Is Bucharest as beautiful as I've heard?
Bucharest is spectacularly beautiful. For one thing, there's a lot more money going on. We spent some time in Bulgaria too, and as I said, the Slovak Republic, Serbia, Croatia. There's a lot of money going into Romania. You know, and you can tell by the amount of construction and renovation and rehabilitation on the buildings that are going on. There was a lot of, you know, Ceausescu was a nightmare as a dictator, and there's a lot of old Soviet buildings that are still there that they're in the process of trying to either tear down or make, you know, make more habitable. But the architecture in Bucharest is stunning, and it, you know, it's one of these things where you walk down like a street, and it seems in the old town that all the streets are tree lined. They're beautiful. You walk down a street, and you'll have, you know, right next to each other some spectacular, you know, 19th century or earlier 18th century mansion that with ornate, you know, ornate facade and gorgeous coloration, and then right next to it is a, you know, an Eastern Orthodox church of one variation or another.
Really,
again, the churches. I think we may have made a mistake here with the idea that, you know, our church buildings can be just, you know, sort of basic, kind of, you know, almost brutalist style architecture. The cathedrals that I saw in Eastern Europe, where, you know, where you see an Orthodox church that pushed for making houses of worship special places, there's a lot to be said for that.
There's
the architecture.
By the way, I agree
with you. The architecture
is
fantastic. It's a very green city in terms of trees, and it has remnants of communism that remind you of the craziness of what was going on there. The presidential, it was going to be Ceausescu's headquarters. The parliament building is this monstrous 1,100 room palace just outside city center.
1,100 room. How do you even know your way around the place?
Well, people do get lost there, and in fact, you can't guide there unless you've passed some kind of very rigorous training that allows you to navigate the building. But it is this monstrous building with tunnels that run from there, you know, like 40 kilometers out to the airport, because Ceausescu wanted to be able to escape if he needed to.
I assume there's some rails levels down there or something. You didn't have to run the.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It goes 9 levels down. You know, there's a nuclear bunker at the bottom, and it is so. And it's what you would expect somebody who came up as a communist to, you know, in the 20th century to do. The architecture is, because he had his hand in it. The architecture is this mishmash of, you know, neo-Greco-Roman styling with all kinds of different styles mixed in there, kind of sort of coupled with kind of a Stalinesque kind of look. But the building itself
did you make it over to Belgrade?
Yes, I spent a day in Belgrade.
Did you see St. Sava?
St. Sava, yes.
Yeah, so that's the...
How do you know about St. Sava, dude?
Well, Hagia Sophia in Constantinople is the, mm-hmm. you know, that's what they modeled it after. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's relatively new, I'll send you guys some pictures of it. The inside of that cathedral is mind-blowing in terms of the artistry and the craftsmanship.
Money's pouring in there, Lou? Is there an industry? Where does everybody work?
Well, that's an interesting question. So Romania, like Bulgaria and well, probably part of Austria going east, is part of what I refer to, or what's known as the Chernozem region, the Black Earth region that goes all the way to Ukraine. So the soil is incredibly fertile. We drove for, 100 miles across areas that could have looked like, Iowa or Kansas, just acres of, sunflowers and corn and rapeseed and soybeans. I mean, pretty much everything grows there. So very strong agricultural presence. Romania has some oil resources, so there's refining. The IT industry is making use of a lot of people there because they tend to be highly educated and not particularly well paid. And the other interesting thing that's going in there is us in Romania. So not too far from Constanta is the largest American air base, next to Ramstein in Europe.
Really?
And we're ramping up there.
So do we pay rent? How do those things work? Do we pay rent, or do we just, because we're pouring money in, it's a even Steven game, or how does it all work?
Typically, it's called a status of forces agreement. Either they make the base, jurisdictionally, like it's part of an American, like an American embassy. Normally, though, what we do is we lease the land, or we get some condition on the land where it allows us to do the improvements in exchange for us, using their contractors, training their pilots, providing upgrades on their military equipment. There's a fair amount of paranoia, unjustified, in places like Poland and the Baltic states, and to a certain extent in the southwestern, in the Balkans, about Russia. And what Russia is capable of doing, and how they'll do it, and the Romanians are being very smart, I think.
I don't know if you were we got a break here, but I don't know if you ever a watcher of I haven't done it in a while, NCIS LA.
No.
Well, for some reason in that show, somebody, the lady who was running that office event, it's a TV show, but she was an operative in Eastern Europe when she was younger, that's the character of the person, that real short lady, Hetty something something, who's sick, and I guess that's why she's left them, whatever. But all her, every once in a while, every like four or five shows, there was this constant theme, but I guess that was her stomping ground, was Eastern Europe and Romania, and she had all kinds of essentially wars, her and these other people that were in secret ops, with that family. What the family you're talking about? That the guy was a dictator.
Ceausescu.
Yeah. Didn't they have didn't he run like a big like mafia family or something over there?
Oh yeah. I mean he was so he had three kids, I think. Only one still alive. The other two, one drank himself to death. The other was a heavy smoker, and they both died early. But the remaining child is like a nuclear physicist somewhere. So he, the kids weren't stupid. Ceausescu and his wife were captured by the military during a revolt in Christmas of 1989, and he basically tried to flee the country. Jumps into his private helicopter, and the military helicopter, and says, fly me to the border so we can get out of here. Instead, the pilot, who was now with the coup plotters, lands him at a military prison. They put him in there. They have a, I think a trial lasted a couple of hours, and then he and his wife were taken out and shot. It was a very, he was a brutal guy, and
well, that's the it's kind of the Kevin just said, Linda Hunt's the actress. That's part of the theme of the show, is the one guy who's the number one agent is the orphan of a lady on the Black Sea that got shot by this gang.
Yeah.
And she takes the orphan in, and so they're still sort of after the kid, and she knows it. So even though they're solving crimes in LA, there's always this backdrop of this family still after him, and she knows about it, and once in a while she goes over there and a bunch of people get I'd love to meet the person who knows all that history, because obviously somebody is putting it into the show from the history that over there. And you know, it's pretty interesting.
So again, Romania, like a lot of former Soviet states in that area in southeastern Europe, is suffering from a brain drain. You know, it's hard. It's very hard for them to keep their talented young people.
Do they have any kind of a big university that people stay for?
They do, but as soon as they finish university, according to every person I talk to, every Romanian I talk to, there, you know, 10 or 15 people. The focus is to get to Western Europe. They have a flood of people working. For example, Constanta, this town, it's a huge seaport on the Black Sea, has a naval college, a nautical college that trains ships officers, and the river cruise company that I was with, along with every other one, as far as I can tell, hires Romanian officers, graduates of the school, because they're really good and they come cheap. But the country seems to be getting back up on its feet. Bulgaria, not so much. I mean, we saw a lot of rural decay in Bulgaria. We drove from the Danube, a place called Rusi, which our listeners can look up on the Danube. We drove from Rusi in to a place called Veliki Tarnava, which is the old medieval capital of the country.
How long of a time do you get before you got to get back to the boat because it moves?
It depends whether the boat's moving or whether it's stationary. So, we had trips that lasted, 10, 11 hours where a bus ride of an hour. So,
okay.
Two hours gets you into the countryside and then you're basically working your way through, like in our case, this medieval, city with fascinating artwork and stuff like that. But what you see in Romania, you don't see in Bulgaria. In Bulgaria, you don't see the kind of, heavy-duty renovation. You see a lot of, broken villages with buildings with the roofs collapsing. And I did say to somebody, we were walking through one of these places, and the guy said, this is a disaster. I said, it is a disaster, but go out into rural America and drive through some of the small towns there.
They're awful. It's awful.
Yeah, in southern Illinois or Kentucky or Ohio, and you're in J.D. Vance land.
Yeah.
But they don't, they just don't have the investment that's needed to do the kind of rehabilitation here.
What's we go to break here, but one of my Polish friends here in the city, who's somehow or another, the kid's a big time sailor and he's a programmer or whatever, and he's he's really into being Polish, whatever that means. I mean, he speaks the language, he lives in the neighborhood. He says a lot of his friends that are younger are not really into the crap show that Chicago has become, and they're going back to the University of Warsaw and they're not coming back.
Yeah.
They're over there, they're percolating
Poland
along pretty good.
So Poland, came out of communism like gangbusters. And I did, when I was working in the former Soviet Union in the 90s, Warsaw was a hot place to go. I mean, they came out rolling right away. They knew what they wanted to do. They organized their economy. They managed the transition to socialism to an economic socialism, very, very well. It didn't go so well in a lot of other places. But it's getting better.
They all get caught up
in Romania.
I mean, Lou, a lot of the stuff we talk about in the show, you included, I bring into the economic discussions because you know more about that than you let on. If you don't do the economic stuff right, a few years ago, for whatever reason, a lot of the mortgages in Poland were denominated in Swiss francs. Is Poland
rather than the zloty? Yeah.
Yeah, And when there was a huge change in the currency, I think a lot of people got screwed big time. And if you don't do this economic stuff right, people get hurt all the time.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've said this many times on the show. I was in Russia in a real-time economic meltdown where I started out the day with rubles. And my friends had told me, do not convert your dollars to rubles except at the point of sale. And as I walked out, they posted the ruble to dollar ratio. And when I started out, it was 1,500 rubles to the dollar. So I was changing my dollars to rubles to buy stuff at that rate. By the time I stopped shopping after lunch, it was over 5,000 rubles to the dollar.
Wow.
And that had, they were changing the signs in the windows of the stores as I was walking along.
A lot of places like that, they wouldn't take the dollars?
They finally just stopped. Well, you know, it was a requirement that you buy and conduct the transaction in rubles, and they finally just stopped taking. And they just said, "We're not selling for rubles." I said, "How about dollars?" He said, "We'll accept dollars any day." And it was a panic, and you could see panic in people's eyes because they had to keep their bank accounts in rubles. And suddenly, you know, your bank account has been devalued by a factor of three. It was a panic.
You're gonna somewhere. You're going to get people always that are going to say, who cares, screw them, kind of thing. But I think, Lou, and you've been there and I haven't, but I read on many different spots, the biggest way of making, saving money in Russia was in American $100 bills.
Yes.
And when we do something like we have in the last 4 to 15 to 20 years, and totally degrade. When I say degrade, if you had a $100 bill 20 years ago, what's it worth now? 40 cents? Really?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And everybody says, well, you know, so what? Screw those Russians that have our money. Well, come on. The idea of somebody's currency, if you want to be the lead dog like we want to be, I think still, maybe not, you can't screw with your currency, and we're doing it.
We're doing it to the detriment of everybody else in the world.
And our own people, by the way.
Yeah. And if you, yeah, including us, if you want me to get on a soapbox and talk about squandered opportunities in the former Soviet Union,
how about we do a real quick break, because we're over that, but that doesn't matter. I'd rather talk to you than have a break. We'll do that real quick. S&P futures down 11, NASDAQ futures down 59. Not much of a bounce here. We'll be right back.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Lone Wolf Pick, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 9. NASDAQ futures down 51. A couple of earnings reports. We had a Chipotle last night, and we had Dr. Pepper today. Both, I think, beat on both. And we, you know, it's one thing to have your national reporters, their nose so far up the behind of government, talking about this 3% inflation in the last year, and how it's down to 2.5 or 3. And yet, the next second, you gleefully talk about firms that have been able to raise their prices 10, 15, 20%. And they crow about it, that's how their revenue went up. So how do you do that in the same newscast, Greg? How do you do that? By the way, yes, inflation's 2%. By the way, here's Dr. Pepper raising their rates 12%. Yes!
I think Whirlpool missed.
Whirlpool did. We had, Google yesterday obviously did. And Tesla was a big clunk. But that company I could never figure out because, to me, all the money they ever made was in getting checks from other people. But that's a story for another day.
I want to buy one of those robots that they're making.
Oh, God. What to do? To make the Greek chow? Anyway, Nikkei was down 12. Yeah, Nikkei was down 1,300. It's 3.3%. Ouch. Hang Seng down 289. 1.7%. Almost under 17,000. 17,022. And yes, Shanghai is under 2,900. Down 15, 28.86. So the Asian markets are not liking our sell-off yesterday at all. DAX down 230, 1.3%. FTSE down 42.5%. They're hanging in there better than anybody. Kakaran down 151, 2%. So we went down later than those guys closed yesterday. So that's being, again, as a review of yesterday's horrible deal. S&P was down 128, and the NASDAQ was down 654. That's 3.6%. I haven't seen that in a real long time. Bonds down 6 basis points, 4.22. The Bund down 4 basis points, 2.40. Japan down 1 basis point, 1.06. Oil down $1.26, down to 76.33. So this is down almost $7 in the last 10 days. It's 9%, Greg? I don't know if are you an oil trader? Or are you? Brent down 132, 80.39. Natural gas unchanged to 11. RBOB down 4 cents, 241. We've got gold, which had a big turnaround yesterday. Now it's down $46. 23.60. When we came in yesterday, it was up 20, so it was $66 higher. It was almost 24.50, and now it's almost under 23.50. Silver down $1.58, 5.4%. Nobody wants anything this morning. Copper down 2 cents, 4.08. We've got the U.S. dollar is 108.4 against the euro. That's not really much change, neither against the pound, 128.7. Bitcoin, even this is down 1,700, 64,151. You guys lowering the price on coffee today, or what are you doing over there, Greg?
Yeah, definitely. 653 here in Chicago, 70 degrees, mostly sunny and nice, high of 75 today. Phoenix, 93, cloudy, dangerous heat, high of 112. They encourage everybody to stay inside today, limit outdoor activities. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 18 minutes. Edens from Lake Hook, 43 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 33 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 18 minutes in, and Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 31 minutes. Baseball news, Brewers beat the Cubs at Wrigley. That was 3-2. White Sox lose in Texas. Rangers, that was 10-2. And Diamondbacks beat the Royals 8-6. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
So, Louie, we've got a couple of wars going. We've got a new presidential candidate. I don't think she's not going to be the candidate. I can't imagine how that could happen at this point, but... all kinds of crazy stuff going on. We had Netanyahu's speech yesterday, which was not all that well received by a lot of people. And I suspect all that's going to be setting up here at the convention, even though Biden is gone. Out of all that stuff, what's your first thing you look at and say, what the hell?
I was a political science major, so the politics stuff is always fascinating to me. What I find fascinating to watch is the lining up, and I mean it's not even being hidden anymore, the lining up of our corporate media establishment to do whatever it takes to promote somebody who has up to now been identified as a very ineffective political person is now being rolled out as the next Margaret Thatcher, or however you want to characterize her, Indira Gandhi, however you want to characterize.
I wouldn't put them in the same class.
Leadership.
I wouldn't put them in the same group.
Well, I'm not politically, yeah, but in terms of their leadership capability.
Well, that's what I mean. I think Margaret Thatcher is one of those brilliant ladies who ever walked.
Well, but so is Kamala Harris. So is Kamala Harris. If you're reading the press reports.
Well, yeah, I guess.
I mean, they're and again. We're not going to, and I don't expect to change anybody's minds about who they're going to vote for. What I want people, my friends and the folks that I talk to notice is how things are being orchestrated to deal with the many problems that she presents as a candidate, starting with the fact that she was, according to Mr. Biden and the people around him, from 1921 on, basically overseeing the administration's efforts on managing the southern border. And they were, the press and everybody else has been referring to her as the border czar for the last 3 years. And they are scrambling now to make sure that that word is removed from any reference to her responsibilities in a, just a bald-faced effort to rewrite history. The point of this is pay attention to what is happening with respect to how these people are being presented, because everything that was done to Donald Trump that was inaccurate and unfair and biased in the corporate press is being done in the other direction with regard to Harris.
Well, it depends on what station you listen to, because...
Well, that's what I mean.
I have a significant other who listens to his Newsmax, and I never heard anything like it, Lou. I mean, it's... But I get... Just as a real...
Newsmax doesn't have the reach of the New York Times.
Right. I know.
Especially within
the
leadership
I get
elites.
Thank God. I don't remember this stuff as well as you do, but I seem to recall that whenever some president puts the vice president in charge of, quote, a problem, it's usually a problem they want no part of. It's a problem that has no solution. What did Obama put Biden in charge of when he was there that was a total fiasco? And Bush put his guy in charge of something that was just something he wanted to be part of, and so I'll put the vice president in charge, and there was no solution.
Okay, well, that's the gig, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're supposed to be the person that's... Harris didn't even visit the southern border.
I'm not saying she's a...
No. My point is that this is a proper measure. I think you look at the border as a proper measure of her competence and ability to solve problems. And it's just one more marker in how you assess her as a potential presidential office holder. And I think that's fair. And what, of course, is happening is because it's inconvenient for the pro or Democrat anti-Trump narrative. And I'm convinced that it's less anti-Trump than it is pro-Democrat, because if Mitt Romney was running against Harris, he'd be the monster with blinders full of women.
One of my Democratic friends said they wish they'd reached across the aisle and run him as a Democrat. He said he'd vote for him in a second. Hey, Greg, how about sending Dan a link?
I would too. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because that was a guy who had demonstrated over and over again that he was smart, he could work with both parties, and he solved problems.
I did actually do something you're never supposed to do, Lou, except you do this stuff. I actually went through a whole deep dive into her background the other day, and I'm going to say, in my opinion, she's a little too young for this yet, okay? But her background was way better than I thought it was, in terms of the experience, in terms of the family and those kinds of things.
In terms of experience, well, she's certainly more qualified in terms of experience than Barack Obama was.
Well, that's what I'm saying. We're way down the line. Yeah.
She hasn't demonstrated any particular competence in any of the jobs
that
she's held, as far as I'm concerned. What she has demonstrated is...
an ability to get them.
Well, but she has demonstrated a very consistent commitment to a particular ideological worldview that, in my opinion, is inconsistent with her being president. But that's my opinion.
By the way, I'm right with you on that. I'm not out of that group. That this is the way.
You're not going to get me to say that I think. Well, Donald Trump is qualified to be president because he's done it once before, and you know the way you're qualified is the people pick you. But he is not my choice. I don't think temperamentally or in a number of other ways, he's not my choice. But he definitely, in my opinion, is a better choice than what I'm being presented with on the other side. That's a matter of opinion. So I'm not going to try to convince anybody. I'm sure I'm not going to convince anybody to change their vote based on that. But all I want to do is call attention to how this election is being orchestrated and how our choices are being manipulated. And I think it's a fair attack to ask Democrat voters the question, are you not feeling just a tad used here?
Greg, did you send Dan a link? Greg?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm with Lou, as you know, I'm hopefully smack dab in the middle on this politics. And follow the money.
Speaking of the devil, he just came on.
Yeah, follow the money. If anybody thinks that she's going to be a winner, the money's going to fly that way. I mean, you were in Chicago long enough to know that if the law firm of Lou, Lou, and Lou is doing a lot of city business and five people are running for mayor, all of them look like they might win, it's a rough year for your firm because you're giving money to all five.
Yeah. 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 And these are the things that drive me nuts. And if I saw some kind of, you know, a conspiratorial cabal operating on the part on behalf of Donald Trump, I'd be screaming about that too. Instead, I mean, if you just look at what happened to him, and I've said this here, I mean,
if he had a better personality, he would have his cabal. He doesn't do a very good job at it.
Maybe that's the case. We both agree that one of his biggest weaknesses is his ability to pick people to work with. And I'm just hoping that this Vance guy is an exception to that rule. And
yeah, I hope so.
We'll see.
Well, you know, right now I think the thing is way more of a toss-up than it was before. Exactly,
because you had one of the candidates basically douse himself in gasoline and then set himself on fire on national television.
Well, plus you had Trump, which can't get off the subject, constantly talking about how incompetent he was. Well, okay, now he's got to come up with something else. Which he probably will, but
well, that's why this border czar rewrite of history is so important, because that goes in my that's an easy competence.
We got a dash here, Lou, but if you're the VP, what do you think would happen? And I'm not saying she's capable of it, I'm not saying she did a good job. What do you think would happen if she actually did go down there five times and come back and say, we have to do these 10 things, like right now today, go out on her own and give a speech and say it, here's my report to the president. What do you think that she'd be paddled or waterboarded tomorrow?
Well, that might be true, but that would certainly cause me to reassess my view of her candidacy.
I mean, what did Pence do behind Trump for 4 years?
Again, she was given a portfolio,
yeah,
with respect to the border, among other things, but she was given a portfolio to do certain things, and she didn't. She didn't even make the effort. And this is consistent, by the way, with the internal criticisms that have dogged her from day one. She doesn't prepare. She's not particularly, you know, intuitively smart, apparently. I don't know. But she doesn't prepare. She shoots off the cuff. When she falls apart in a presentation or whatever, she blames her staff. 90% of her staff.
I think there's an amazing, get a load of this, similarity between her and Trump, in the sense that they will not read, they will not do the work. They think they have this innate something, and they don't. They're totally different than the Winston Churchills of the world that read everything that came their way to the point where maybe they screwed up their judges by doing. There's no intellectual massive curiosity in either one of them, I don't think.
I don't think that's true as much for Trump because of his business background. But in any event,
well, whatever. Listen, we'll never know. Lou, good to have you back, buddy. Glad to hear the report of what's going on over there. One of these days, I get which brand did you go? Which river thing?
Oh, it was Viking.
Okay, there's like two or three that are pretty big, right?
Yeah, Viking, ANA Waterways, Avalon.
How'd you pick those guys?
Any number of European cruises. The Viking for us is pretty good because it's very consistent and consistently good in terms of our experience there.
Okay, so I mean, what percentage of meals eat on a boat versus on land?
95%
on the boat.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not like when you get off in the morning, you know, breakfast and lunch is where you're walking and dinner's back on the boat or something like that.
Oh, no. It's when you're living on the boat, you can eat all meals there, and they book for that. The food was, you know, good to fantastic.
Okay.
I'm a fan. I'll just put it that way.
Because there's some that only move at night, right?
I don't know about that. We did a lot of our traveling in the evenings, obviously, because daytime is for touring. But it was a 17-day deal.
Okay, so you only had a long one, right?
Yeah, we had time in the afternoons. You know, just go up and sit on the upper deck, as long as there was a breeze blowing, and just watch the countryside go by. It's you see a lot and learn a lot.
Okay, all right. We'll talk to you next week. But SP Futures down 8, and NASDAQ Futures down 41. What do you say we go right to Dan? Dan, you with us?
Sure.
How are you, buddy?
Sure. Yeah. I'm here.
It's a good thing you're back. You got to explain yesterday, Lucy. Explain yesterday.
Explain the sell-off in the
market. Yeah, yeah. Just a little bit of a sell-off.
Well, a couple things. I mean, first we had a major rally on Friday. You know, that seemed to go well past where valuations are. Should be marked. And I think yesterday was give back a lot. Some of it had to do with some poor earnings that are coming out. I mean, you know, UPS came out with some really bad numbers. And then even the numbers for Alphabet and Tesla, the reports weren't very positive. You know, the thing that we're coming up against right now in earnings season is poor valuations or valuations that are not meeting the levels where these stocks are trading. So I think that's part of it. I don't think it's going to continue. And if you can believe this, I actually got in and was buying the last 15 minutes. I was buying the Qs and I was buying some of the, you know, the VTI, which is the Vanguard Total Index. And actually had wished I had bought, because I had a very strong premonition about a month ago to add a little bit of small stock exposure. And you could do that through the ticker symbol IJR. And that small stocks had rallied 10%. And they had a nice rally on Monday. Some of that was given back yesterday. I still think we're okay for the short run. There's still an enthusiasm that's going way past the valuations. There's still that momentum. There's still that fear of missing out. While the political news seems to be mixed, there also seems to be, depending on who you're listening to and where you're getting it from, there seems to be an overwhelming support for having a new candidate in office. I think the polls that I had seen Biden Trump versus Harris Trump. The Harris Trump poll actually was stronger, and not totally surprising, but I think all of that was playing into the rally that we've seen. And then I think the sell-off that we saw yesterday was just, you know, earnings coming out that weren't as good as expected. You know, expectation that additional reports that are coming out in the next few weeks aren't going to be stellar. Concerns about the overvaluation in tech stocks especially. And, you know, I've been telling everybody I know that has 90% exposure to equities and 88 of that is in tech, and they're 65 years old. I'm telling them that you have to take some off the table. Sometimes I get that deer in the headlights look when I make that comment, but you got to take some off the table.
It looks like they're finally listening to you.
Yeah, listen.
I hope so. You know, I hope so. It's just at some point you just can't be greedy, right? I mean, it ends up becoming greed. It ends up becoming comfort. And, you know, if you've made, you know, if we look back, you know, 3 years from now and say, hey, I made 95% of that upside since 2009. You know, who cares if you lost the last 5%? You've been able to lock in what you've earned. And I think that's very important. And although everyone's situation is, you know, as individuals, everyone's situation is different in terms of wanting, you know, if this money is in a taxable account, you're trying to protect taxes, that's one thing. But overall, I would say there's still a very strong tone in the market. I don't think we see things turning down. I don't think this is an inflection point. I think it's a bad day. But I do think we'll see some good days in front of us as well.
I think you can make as usual in the market, which by the way, makes it a market, right? you can always make a case for sort of whatever. And you look at the news and you look at the different stuff, and you see companies doing this and that. And you look at something like this Tesla. Now, we know the guy's a brilliant man and he's in a bunch of different stuff. We also know that the company was basically floated and check some other people with this ridiculous carbon thing. So now all of a sudden, they're loaner prices. We're talking about a P.E. ratio that is pretty darn high, right? And even now. And they basically told you that no matter how much money they make, they're going to give the money to Musk and not to you, right? They're never going to pay a dividend. So somewhere along the line, you do need to assess where you are on the investment page in this country. I mean, if you went and listened to this guy talk, you may love him and the company. I don't know that you'd ever put a dime in there, Dan. I mean, in terms of you getting something back where he feels he owes you an obligation. I don't think he thinks he owes you anything.
Right.
I mean, it's a whole different this celebrity CEO world. You ask yourself, you know, where am I? If I was a mosquito investor, would the guy swat me? I mean, it's like you ask yourself, you know, and you talk about me on the same page, not you personally. You talk about, I just mentioned before you came in, we have a Powell who claims he's going to wants to get down to 2%. Well, I don't buy that for a second, but let's say he does, or he's down to 3. Now, what they're telling us, it's 2 or 3. Okay, you know, I'm not. Don't want to get involved in a huge conversation about the CPI, but the next word out of somebody's mouth on TV or business news, hey, guess what? Dr. Pepper raised their prices 13%. Yes. Okay. Well, what if they couldn't have raised their prices 13%? What did Dr. Pepper's earnings look like? What do, you know? What does the day
That's
before
a good point.
The Chipotle Mexican Grill? Everything is their prices are up. What 11.8%? They said in the thing or something.
Yeah.
I mean, what if they couldn't have? Well, they're not making a dime.
Yep.
I mean, it's
no. I think you make a really good point, and the thing, you know, one of the things I was going to mention too is while we've seen some moderation in growth, while we've seen some slowing in growth, while we talk about the inflation level coming down, it's exactly what you're saying, Chief. That if you look around, you know, if you're at the grocery store, I was having sticker shock the other day, thinking that I thought things had normalized, and I didn't think that, you know, the loaf of bread that was already $4.50 is now almost $6, the exact same loaf of bread. And this just tells me that that it hasn't stopped and that it's continuing. You know, we're continuing to see inflation and things. Certainly we've talked about medical expenses, we've talked about contractors, we've talked about utilities, public utilities. You know, certainly we've seen in many parts of the country, not everywhere, but although there's been a normalization in real estate, there are still places where real estate is going up. So pretty much across the board, there still is inflation that you can see every single day. And I think it's, you know, we have to take a look at that rather than strictly listening to the, you know, to some talking head or some, you know, economist that has an axe to grind or is trying to you know, make a point. Our belief is that we're sticking to our knitting, although we are trying to participate in some short-term rallies in the market, and we're always looking for good undervalued opportunities in the equity market. But you know, you're still getting 5.4% for 1- and 2-month T-bill. It still provides the tax benefit for state and local tax. They're state and local tax exempt. And one other area that I want to stress that's still very, very attractive, especially in those taxable accounts, is municipal bonds. Yesterday we were buying munis at 5.75, single A rated, and after tax, depending on if you're in Illinois, New York, California, some of that New Jersey, some of the higher tax states, that's, you know, that's like a 7.5% return on a single A bond. So I'd much rather stick with that in my taxable account than go, you know, long on an equity that or in the stock market in general that is clearly overvalued.
What we did a bunch of T-bill stuff in the last week or two, and we're since you weren't on last week, I couldn't ask you. We did half 3 months, half 6 months for virtually everybody that wants to do that. The thought was maybe we should go out and grab there is no 9 month, and the yearly ones, they go off the auction pretty rarely. If you had the ability, which we do, and you do, should we try and snag a 9 month, or we just stick with the three and a six.
See, we buy in the secondary market, so we're able to buy, you know, something that, you know, T-bill that may have been issued as a one-year T-bill, and then we can actually make, we can buy it at 9 months.
Well, I guess my question is, I think we can do that too, but let's put it this way, the percentage, if somebody had $1 million right now, we're going, actually I did half, quarter, and then I was going to ask you. I think the 6 month is still probably okay. Six month
is okay. 3 month is going to be better in terms of yield.
We're doing half and half.
Is going to be even better in terms of yield. What's interesting, Chief, is buying corporate bonds. So in other words, corporate bonds are, the way you value them is the spread over the comparable treasury. So let's use a 1 year. Say we're looking at a 1 year corporate bond and it's yielding 6%. Well, over the 1 year T-bill, that might be 100 basis points. So one full percentage more. But if you look at that spread over a 2 month or 3 month T-bill, that drops to 60 basis points, even though that's not the comparable measurement. But what I'm saying is, if you can get 540 for a 3 month T-bill, why buy a 10-year corporate at 560?
I agree.
That's where I still believe the very short term makes sense. It is not, the way the market is trading is not following, well, it is following the trends, because it is, the inverted yield curve is still telling us that we're going to continue to see a slowdown in the economy. Now, the good news, and this is a really good thing for our economy, I believe, is that this slowdown has been gradual. It hasn't been hitting every sector of the market at every day. It's been a very nice gradual slowdown. That being said, there's still all this money pumping into the system. There's that snowball effect where people making more money in their, whether it be their retirement accounts or their individual equity accounts, and they're saying, I can buy more. The really important message is rebalancing and trimming. I use the word trimming. If you're up 10%, sell that 10%, put it in a protective strategy. Put half of it in a protective strategy, put half of it in bonds. And I think what happens at that point is you're really capturing the return that you've made, and you're not going to be in a situation down the road where we see a sudden downturn that comes from some unexpected event and you have a lot of exposure and you're 65 and you're about to retire.
Well, you certainly can see that in some of these earnings plays. Earnings.
Yes.
In Florida, it's not like you guys don't get UPS packages. You do. But Chicago, I mean, we have had over the years at PTI a real lot of people who compound out of UPS and a lot of their profit share. I'm not sure, Dan, if they have a separate 401k plan. I don't think so, because it seems like everybody piles out of there with $1.5 million in UPS stock that has worked their whole, you know, most of their life there. And it's A shares, and then we have to get it to B or something like that. And that stock was down $20 2 days ago or yesterday, that's a massive drain. And I mean, certainly in the Chicago area, there's got to be hundreds of these people, maybe thousands, that were former UPS employees that have virtually all of their, they all have a tax basis of like, you know, $5 or something. So whenever you sell something, you gotta kick, you know, whatever, 20-some% of it right to the government or more, and by the time you pay the state and everybody else, and it this stuff, these things coming down here. I mean, if you get a few more days like yesterday, you could just say, hey, we're back to June 10th in the market. What's the problem? But you and I know it's not the same, because people borrowed money to get them there. They borrowed for the extra stuff that it's. If we have a few more days like yesterday, you know, we've got problems. And I look at these companies, and there's no kind of fallback. I mean, it was when I say fallback, yep. I mean if you and I buy a six flat, and we pay, you know, whatever, $1 million for the place, and it's returning $100,000 a year, and 2 years later, you know, the thing, something happens to the economy and it's worth 850, we don't really care. We care, but we're still getting our 100 grand a year, and that's right. Our fallback position is our income.
Asset.
Whatever it is. I mean, maybe the interest rate went up or did something. It's now not worth the million, but guess what? We're still getting the 100,000 a year. Well, there's nothing to fall back on at Tesla. There's no check right. coming to you. See, I'm not saying sell it. I'm not giving investment advice. I'm saying, but what is worst case scenario? Worst case scenario, the stock goes down and you got nothing.
Right. You don't have assets behind you in most cases, and you also have in that specific case, you have a CEO who's spread pretty thin between Tesla and his other businesses and his other ventures and all that. And we really believe strongly that the leaders of an organization, the management team, the CEO, president, CFO, whoever the leaders are the ones who really make or break any organization. And that's why we spend so much time talking to management before, during, and after we invest. They're really the ones who are critical. And one of the basic things we look at is the focus that the management team has on their business. And as soon as they start getting focused elsewhere, that's where I lose interest.
Well, plus again, whatever the company makes, he thinks he deserves.
Oh, and that too. I mean, that's giving back to shareholders is really important. You know, treating employees well is very important. These are the things that make for long-term, good, solid, long-term organizations. Unfortunately, not only Tesla, but some of the other organizations have moved away from that model of treating employees well and providing incentives that go, you know, there's a period where the incentives were amazing for younger people to come in and, you know, a lot of work from home, a lot of additional benefits, paternity leave, a lot of things that made for a more balanced lifestyle, and then those things have actually been taken away in many cases. I know Amazon is one that has, and a number of the other tech firms have taken away these benefits that were really the benefits that lured the top talent into these organizations. My concern is why management would shift gears or become less focused. I use the same analogy with, and it can be used for any type of business. And I think of it because I spend a lot of time in the gym, and I think of a gym owner who I knew from years ago who raised his rates because he was having trouble, you know, paying his bills. Well, that's not how you get your – that's not how you keep your members. You don't raise your rates. You might offer a few other benefits, or you might – you know, there's a number of other things you can do. And those people who even at a small business level feel that they have to raise rates or take away a benefit – are not going to retain top talent. Same thing with the larger firms. And that's why I think the Teslas and the Amazons are going to continue to run into trouble as time goes on. And and even Alphabet, I think, is having the same issue. So that's what we've talked about in the past. There are these things going on behind the scenes that unless you know somebody working there or a friend's son or daughter is working there, you're not going to be aware of some of the inside the company stuff, and that includes the corporate morale. That includes, what's really going on at the operations level of the organization.
Well, some of that stuff, Dan, you mentioned. And that's why I think you like and actually do go out and talk to these guys, because
yes.
If you don't, you have no idea if that stuff's going on. If a company, I'll say something. For instance, actually, before I forget. Well, you mentioned, did you read the report here on Southwest?
Yes.
It's exactly what you're talking about. The revenue is up, yes. Like, what, 4%? Their expenses are up 13%. So somehow or another, some people, that's why inflation is not good, because it's always uneven. Now, you talked about the health club can't raise their rates. Well, if you happen to be, your health club is sitting next to some, I'm going to say some company that's doing spectacular, and everybody got a big raise, you guys can raise your rates whatever the hell you want, people will pay.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, if you're sitting somewhere where that's not the case, you raise your rates, going, hey, what the hell? I'll do my push-ups at home. Or, I mean, it's still not as nice having a club, but it's all about whether you can or where you are in that the chain. And, as a brokerage firm, we can't raise rates, nor would we really want to, but,
right.
I mean,
yes.
we're not into that soup. All of a sudden, tomorrow, what happens if something happens in the industry and everybody's I don't think anybody ever would. We're going to be charging 5 cents a share for stock. Well, I don't know why that would happen necessarily, but I mean, if you just get swept along in this. You're either a winner or a loser. And I don't know why. Maybe so many places closed during COVID on the restaurant side that those guys seem to have some pricing power. At least the fast food ones do. Maybe because it's location or something. I don't think the smaller people necessarily do. I mean, if you see the regulars that sit around the bar in, you know, some Irish place, and all of a sudden they walk in the next night and a beer's $2 higher, I'm not so sure they have an issue if everybody's retired in the place. But now if you're on Michigan Avenue and the tourists come in, maybe you can get away with it. You know, the $25 martini. It's all about specifics. That's why you don't want to let it happen, right?
Absolutely, yeah. There's no question about it. We see it in the grocery stores. We see it in places. And I agree with you, Chief, that it really does depend who the customers are, whether it be at a local restaurant or whether it be at a manufacturing, an industry in the manufacturing sector, that your regulars are going to, you know, start questioning or actually start considering alternatives if the company is using rate hikes as a way of making ends meet, or in some cases as they do that to stay greedy, if you will. It is not the way to continue to run a business, especially when you have loyal customers. You at least have to offer some other type of service. And again, as I'd like to think, and this is where I get a little confused, but I would like to think one of the great things about being here in the United States is that the capitalist system, the freedom of starting a business to compete, you know, providing a restaurant down the street that not only has better service, better prices, and maybe a more interesting menu, maybe they have a happy hour with drinks at a slightly lower price. I personally am the kind of guy that would check that place out, I miss my regular place maybe, but I'll check that place out. And then suddenly that maybe become the new place, and you tell your friends. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is there's the thing about the United States that we don't want to change is we don't want competition to stop.
Well, we have changed.
But then we start looking at the big seven, and we start looking at some of the companies that are, I'm not sure, the barriers to entry to get into the fields they're in, like Meta or Apple, Amazon. I'm not sure that those barriers to entry have become so strong and so solid that it's difficult for.
I don't see how you could. I mean, that's what the funny thing is. Whenever you talk, you specifically, me too, by the way, talk about the American way, we always zero in on about five industries. It's going to be your restaurants. Might even be in Chicago. I mean, there's tremendous competition in the food stores. I mean, it's unbelievable. Right. I mean, there's got to be 10 names here, and they're all percolating and. And obviously in the Midwest, your agricultural community is amazingly competitive. I'm going to say I know a couple of ladies that are beauticians. They're competitive. I mean, we can name them, but once we get off one hand onto the second hand, and clearly I don't think we need the toes to start counting. I don't know if we get more than about 10 of them that are there. Now you start talking about, well, where do I really spend my money? Well, our business, we spend a lot of stuff on, like, Microsoft crap, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see anybody, if they see another company, they buy them, you know?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what's happening.
I can't imagine how much, or Meta or Google. And Meta, I don't use Facebook because of the regulatory stuff. Every time I send something out, somebody have to watch me. So I don't really have a Facebook account. But, I mean, all that stuff, that all gets together. Who's the big firm here that was going to get bought by somebody for billions of dollars and they just bagged out? They're going to do an IPO instead? Alti or somebody, Aspie, you know,
right.
Wiz,
yeah, they said no,
he said no to 20 some billion. What
yeah.
was it?
Yeah, yeah,
yikes.
Well, I mean, it could be the world's biggest flop, or it could be
30.
Yeah, it could be, it could be worth 40 2 years from now. I mean, I hope for those guys that they had the stones to say no. I hope for them they're worth double. I honestly do, but I mean, I don't see how we. I mean, the big kids on the block, Dan, and this is affects everything you and I do. I mean, the reason why, I know a young lady, you weren't on last week, not, well, she's not young anymore, but she's young. Anyway, terrific lady. She was on a cruise, and she comes off with COVID, and she gets this new, what's the new drug? Greg, you know the name of the damn thing. It's a new COVID drug from Pfizer. With her insurance, it's $1.25. Without her, it's $1,200 for a week.
Wow.
Okay, so we, the guys that like to go down to the bar and get a beer, we can't afford that. You know, I coined a term while you were going, shockflation.
Yeah.
Where it's the thing that our buddy Kenny was talking about it yesterday. His wife evidently got rear-ended. I don't know what kind of car he's got. You probably do because you had dinner with him. He must have a nice new car.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a horrendous bash-up. He said with the electronics and everything and the backup cameras and all the other crap, $25,000 to fix it.
Yeah.
That would be, you know, 10 years ago, two, three.
New car.
You know, but he said they wouldn't total it because the thing must have cost $75,000 or something.
Right.
And but now one of the guys, you know, nowhere near, you know, Kenny's kind of car. I'm having a beer with a dude last Friday, and he's honest guy, and he's just a regular dude. He works for some mortgage company, and he goes, my air conditioning went out. Well, the guy in the neighborhood wants like $3,700, and I call up you know, one of these big houses, and they want like $7,000.
Yeah.
He goes, well, I don't have the $35,000, much less the $7,000. What do you suggest I do? I said, you know what? For the unit downstairs, go to Menards, buy yourself two nice window units for like $700, save up some dough and get it fixed over the wintertime where they're cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, it's a number that he's dealing with the extra the extra buck for the beer from a year ago, right? He's probably dealing with food and he's dealing with, you know, gasoline or parking. Gasoline hasn't gone up that much, but parking. He's dealing with all that, and all of a sudden here comes one from left field and he's like, what the bleep? And I think, you know, lady downstairs from me has two nice Frenchies, bulldogs.
Yeah,
and she's kind of living paycheck to paycheck. And one of these days, unfortunately, there's going to be a vet bill, and she's going to go, how does a vet bill be $3,000? You know, I mean, it's stuff you don't think about. Stuff you don't think about that's kind of hovering around you like an asteroid ready to hit you in the head.
They always said, for individuals, I think they said keep a six-month safety account. Keep an account that'll allow you to live for 6 months because maintenance does happen. And if you own a home, anyone who owns a home knows that there's constant maintenance. There's always something. You always have a to-do list of something going out, whether it be, you know, something simple and or something more complicated. And that's the requirement, I think, for any homeowner is to have at least 6 months of emergency funds or. But you're right also, I mean, in terms of Kenny's car, I'll also say, because that happened to me, and the problem was the guy that hit me was drunk, but he also didn't have insurance, nor did he have deep pockets. So that's an issue that's, you know, that can happen in Florida because they don't push, you know, the insurance. There's no absolute requirement to have insurance, or it can lapse after the first month. So there's a large number of uninsured motorists. So I was able to use my insurance, but there's some that doesn't seem quite equitable. But to your point that you were making, the way I tell, what I tell others, especially clients but also friends, is shop around. And just as you were shopping around for, you know, the local AC guy versus the larger organization being double, no matter what it is, whether you're a contractor, you're getting an estimate on a car or whatever it happens to be, whether you're getting a haircut. Something as simple as a haircut, you can go one place and it's $20 for a beard trim and a haircut. You, two doors down, it's $60 for the same thing. And at least at the place that's $20, you have a, you know, a barber or a couple people in the barber shop that are kind of fun and, you know, make the environment cool when you're there. But shopping around is really important, and that's what we do when we're looking at investments. We don't just buy the first thing that comes along. We're looking for value. We're looking for the better of many choices, because we have a lot of choices out there. And that goes back, I'm kind of somehow or another tying this back into the high price of equities right now, especially these tech stocks. Overpaying is, it's not in my blood. You know, some people have that, you know, they like that excitement about watching something go up and up and up. But at some point, that roller coaster is going to turn over. You're going to reach the top of the ride, and then it goes downhill, and it can go downhill very quickly. So I would just say, be very careful. Be especially careful with paying for anything in the market, is what I'm primarily speaking of, but I'm speaking about outside of the market too. Anything that is clearly overvalued, clearly, and I think the more people that have that hesitation in buying, sometimes you don't have a choice. That's what's going to help bring prices down.
Well, Dan, what? How do you? We by the way, U.S. economy grew at a 2.8% pace in the second quarter, much more than expected.
Yes.
I think if you, first thing I have to say, what was the deflator? And we probably aren't going to agree with the deflator, but. Anyway, how do you, when you go from, I mentioned the story about the six flat, which is, you know, basic investing, obviously, and then you go to a company that routinely, you know, makes money, good years, bad years, but whatever it is, they pay 40% out to other people, and you can sort of get a value on that. Now, granted, they can go under two, and all of a sudden you got no dividend, right? It's not like that a dividend makes things safe. I mean, it ought to, but doesn't always. But then you get to a place where like a Tesla, and again, I'm not trying to beat up on it. The dude is real happy with a $50 billion bonus, right? I mean, or other places, you look at some of these airlines, and now they're all kind of hurting because the rates are down all a right. bit. And I'm going to say, for a period of a decade, United Airlines took every dime they had, and instead of buying planes with it or sending it out as a dividend, bought stock back. Now, I don't think that goes to anybody because the stock is lower than when they bought it. I mean, right. they can say they're returning money to shareholders, but they're returning money to shareholders that don't want to be there anymore. My sarcastic assessment. How much of what, when you, like I say, the Dan Janitas that is unusual is you go to a place and say, hey, Joe, what are you doing? How much money are you making? What are your expenses? How much do you get paid? How much do you return to people? What are your bonds paying? And, oh, by the way, looks to me like you're making way more than you're paying out in the bonds, so it's somewhat safe. How do you get from there to not knowing what these guys are doing, what they're paying, what they're going to spend the money on next, and trying to put a value? You know, I guess my question, a long way of saying it, make it a long story short, don't tell it. How the hell do you put a number on a Meta or a Google or an NVIDIA? That guy's never going to give you any money. I mean, how do you put a number on that other than you hope they get the hype for longer and actually do grow and they double in stock price. I mean, which is great, by the way. But how do you, when there's nothing else to lean on, how do you put a number
in? Yeah. No, I think that's an excellent question. The people who are trying to make those predictions need to, and what they don't do, but they need to do more of, is talk to employees. They need to really understand the culture of the organization. You know, how have things changed for the employees? What's the motivation for the top talent to stay there? You know, they also need to think about R&D. You know, what's coming down the line in terms of new development, and how successful is that going to be? Because every new project and every new type of technology is not necessarily going to succeed. They also need to talk to customers and see, you know, kind of get their own idea about how customers are perceiving both changes, but also the customer's perception of the organization and their financial situation. And then finally, you definitely want to be talking to somebody on the inside about, you know, the CEO or somebody who really understands the finances. You want to know how the company is currently, you know, what the capital structure looks like, where they expect to spend money on their next, whether it be acquisition or how much more are they going to put into R&D. And you also want to make sure that there's liquidity. And one theme that I've heard, Chief, recently, and I'm not 100% sure this is true, but I'm hearing that there is a lot more liquidity with the larger tech companies than there's ever been. Liquidity can mean cash on the balance sheet. It can mean marketable securities, but it can also mean the ability to sell a certain part of the business, or, you know, you look at certain part of the business as being an asset that can be spun off if there was trouble. And again, in my mind, the way I look at things, having been a high yield bond portfolio manager for so long, you want to have that sense of liquidity. Liquidity is also measured, as you know, in the markets and how easily things trade. I'm shifting gears here a little, but to get back to the markets, if you recall, you know, over the last few weeks, we've had this nice run in small cap stocks. And what I think had been keeping that from happening prior to the last few weeks and keeping small stocks undervalued was the fact that small stocks are not as liquid. And to me, it was an indication that there was concerns about liquidity. Well, now all of a sudden those concerns have changed, not only the liquidity within these companies, but also the liquidity within the market. So the thought is that we're in a much better environment. We're in a much more liquid environment. And my answer to that is, for somebody who trades every single day, it's somewhat true, but it's not quite as true as what we're hearing.
Well, Dan,
my answer for that with the company is the exact same thing. Yes, some of these companies have more liquidity, but not necessarily. You have to really dig into the numbers, and you have to get to understand what's going on there to see just how liquid they truly are.
Well, it's coincidental with this economy report here. S&P futures are now up 8. S&Ps are up 75 cents. NASDAQ are up 10. Dan, you mentioned employees, and I'll use the term I've been using, you know, for what you're talking about, the human capital.
Yes.
In a place. My question, boy, I hope you have a stab at this, because I don't. So you don't have to worry about me disagreeing with you. If somebody has this reputation, who knows if the reputation is correct, of being amazingly employee friendly, all right? I mean, Google had that for a long time, right?
Yeah.
Where, it was a open, nobody even had cubicles, everybody was out and open. There's ping pong, there's lunch, there's all kinds of stuff going on. But the idea was to get as much as you could out of your people talking back and forth with each other, or the ideas back and forth. And somebody takes that. Now, there's a cost to that, right? Obviously. And so all of a sudden you get a new CEO in. I'm not saying Google did, or I'm using that name. And all of a sudden the guy goes, well, screw this. I'll go to the ping pong tables. I'm not buying these bleeps lunch. And all of a sudden you start ratcheting down. By the way, you know, there's not going to be the employee trip every quarter. We go away for a weekend. We're not going to do that anymore. What is the lag time between them kind of turning the screws a little bit? It's kind of a wrong term, but... And all of a sudden, your best people leave. But it's not going to happen tomorrow. I mean, what's the drain, and how do you? Obviously, the people who leave, everybody's worth something, man.
Absolutely.
But if you have a place of, 500 people, probably 450. I won't say are replaceable, but they're regular good people, and maybe 50 are somewhat special. And you really don't want those 50 leaving. I mean, you're still going to be able to deliver stuff, the business, with the other 450, but it's not the same. But if some exec comes in, pisses them all off, and you lose 25 of them, first of all, how do you even know it? And secondly, what's the comeback? What does it take to get, now that your reputation has gone south, how do you turn that bus around?
Yeah, those are excellent questions. And the how do you know it, meaning you're asking the question, how does an investor know it?
Yeah.
How does somebody on the outside know it? No, and that's very true, because that is well hidden. So unless you know those employees or friends, and in my case, the parents of some of those younger people who work there, hearing the stories directly from them, you may not see it, and it may take a while, but then it may hit you over the head, because now they're having trouble replacing those people because they don't have the same level of talent to replace them. What I'm seeing, again, isn't just my mosaic theory by asking people who are in different industries who've had these benefits that have been taken away, just how it's happening. In a lot of cases, especially in tech, the younger people working there who are wizards, I mean, amazingly smart people, for some reason, whether it be the company telling them this or the market telling them, don't have the sense of self-confidence to say, yeah, I can go down the street and work for XYZ tech company any day of the week, and by the way, I can get paid more. Don't see that happening as much as we did, a year ago. I've used the analogy a few times with my sister's boyfriend, who's an aerospace engineer, who is getting paid lots and lots of money and getting lots of raises and bonuses and all that, and even a promotion at the age of almost 70. And now finally they're telling him he has to come into the office. Well, he's been used to working for an hour or two at home, and that's changing even there. And the reason that lasted so long with that company, and this goes back to your original question, is that they have government contracts that are now coming due. So in the tech companies, they might have a project or a program going on that has a certain life, and then once they finish that program, if they don't have something that's where they can employ the, you know, that they can keep the employee's time full, then that might be when they sort of gradually, you know, get rid of some of these benefits. So it happens over a period of time. When it happens quickly, that's a negative, that's a sell indicator, or at least trim indicator on your stock. When you have somebody coming in new and cleaning a house, it could be a good thing, but I would stay away for a period of time. I'd want to have some time to look at that company and see, you know, how this new regime has worked out. And it doesn't always have to be a negative thing, because in some cases they could retain the best talent and have them work more efficiently than a larger staff.
And what do you make of, I want to shift gears on here a little bit, what do you make of the huge turnaround in the metals in the last, since yesterday morning?
Yeah, we actually have been buying silver. We think that there's, you know, there's opportunity. Metals, and if you look at commodities as a whole, I think look very attractive. Look at what's happened to, you know, oil prices coming down. You know, maybe looking more attractive now at these levels than they certainly did a few months ago. It's, you know, we're not even at the end of the summer, right? You know, traditionally you wouldn't see this kind of sell-off. In terms of metals, I think everything is normalizing. And when we look at basic materials as a whole and we look at raw materials, it is such a positive thing for the economy to see pricing coming down.
Well, the gold's down $60 since yesterday morning. I get this weird feeling with the market falling off this much and these metals turning around. Something came out yesterday morning that I didn't get the memo. There's clearly a tone change since yesterday morning at 8 o'clock, and I can't put my finger on what it is.
I hear you. I'm thinking that it's short term. You know, I'm not sure that this is a long term trend. I still think the cycle for metals, for gold, silver, and for some of the other commodities, I think we have more room to go here. This might be a little blip. I think some of it comes down to, when you're thinking of silver and some of the other metals, it will come down to demand, because those are metals that are used. I think it's a positive, again, for having raw materials in manufacturing, that any drop in prices is a positive for those companies. The rationale behind it may be consistent with the rationale behind the equity market. But in the case of metals and commodities, I would not say they've been overpriced. So there's the difference.
Well, you wonder on this oil. Of course, there's so much involved in it. I mean, Danny, you and I are usually very careful to not pick one headline and say, that's right. But it seems to me that a lot of what you're seeing in some of the stocks, like your UPSs, like what's going on in the oil, like what's going on in a few other places. I mean, oil was up in the low 80s 10 days ago. Now it's like mid-70s. That's kind of a lot in a week and a half without any Saudi news or anything like that. The fact that there doesn't seem to be any news here, I mean, there's a lot of news about, you know, assassination attempts. Those are big news. And changing of the president on the other side, or a presidential candidate. I wonder if we really aren't, beneath all the hoopla, we're not slowing down pretty dramatically here. I mean, I wonder.
We are slowing down, there's no question. And as I mentioned, I'll pat myself on the back for a minute here. At the very beginning of the year, my annual letter said that we're in an excellent place. You know, we're going to see improvement in the economy. We're going to see improvement in the financial markets. Both stocks and bonds look attractive. And this was January 1st. But what I did say, and I have said it the last few times I've been on, expect more volatility between now and the election. And it's not just because of which candidate gets in and which policies get implemented. It has to do with just, frankly, one thing, and that's uncertainty. And in addition to that, some of the measures of the Federal Reserve raising rates are starting to be realized. This was, there was like a 9 to 18 month lag after rates were, you know, after we've seen rates trickle up. And I don't believe we're going to see any rate cuts anytime soon, despite that, you know, I think they overanalyze it on
well, it's 100% chance of a quarter point cut in September, according to the...
Yeah, 100% chance, but let's see if that even comes to fruition, because, yeah. You know, as you're mentioning, we're going to continue to see, you know, if you see numbers that's... You mentioned a couple different things. I mean, we're seeing a slowdown, but then we're also seeing... you know, GDP numbers and production numbers and PCI numbers that are coming in a little stronger than expected. So it's a balancing act, and it's one where I don't think the Fed wants to make a mistake. And I think in this case, I think they're going to be late rather than early.
Well, there's a huge bifurcation. I was at for a term this early in the morning between what you see in the numbers coming out of Washington and the numbers you're seeing coming out of like the Empire State Survey and the Philly Fed and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
They're all horrible.
Exactly, yeah. and one further, the companies, right? When the companies, because they've been reporting lately, and then you see something totally different, and it's interesting to see the market's reaction. I mean, certainly when the EPS numbers came out, that stock got trashed, and that, you know, and you know, because they came, you know, they missed expectations, but also I think it set a bigger picture for trend in the industry. So you've got a combination of things. You've got the polls coming out, some of which I agree with, and some of which I don't take too much. I don't believe too much. I think we have to get data and firm data, not only from the government, but most importantly from the companies. The companies are really going to be the ones who tell us what's going on, and they can also tell a bigger picture story, especially when you're seeing a larger company like UPS in the you know, in their industry, you know, FedEx, UPS, you kind of look at those companies, that's going to tell a message as well. So that's where I think we need to pay attention.
Well, Dan, we have a long conversation with Professor Hal the other day.
Okay.
And he's on the air, and we're talking about these interest rates and the idea that somehow you've got this short-term rate hanging in there at what? Say 5.5, 5.25, 5.5, and your long-term rate is 4.5. Okay, well, that's been a real long time that's been. Whatever they call it. It's the upwardly sloping yield curve or the downwardly sloping, which you don't.
Yeah, it's an inverted yield curve.
Inverted, which is not. I mean, ask yourself. I mean, some of these questions. It's been like this for so long. You wonder if people know the answer. In theory. If you're going to lend somebody some money for 6 months, okay, versus lending it to them for 10 years, there's way more currency risk and other risk over 10 years, so you're going to want a higher rate. I mean, that's just the way the world ought to operate.
Right.
Yet we've been operating differently now for like quite a while. And now normally one would think the short-term rates are maybe a little frisky at 5.5, and the long-term rates are maybe a little low at 4.5, a little historically low. Or actually, a 10-year is 4.2, a 30-year is 4.5, are historically low. And everybody is convinced that they're going to beat up on the Fed and lower the short-term rates. Except you got this sort of little fly in the ointment that the federal government is running a deficit to the tune of 40-45% of their budget. And the weird part is, despite all this part about how the economy's grown and grown and grown, the fact is the tax receipts are not going up very much. Nowhere near as much as they should be going up if you listen to this story. I mean, the story is the same no matter who's in the office, whether it's Democrat or Republican. They give you this rose-colored story, and you look at the numbers, and they're sort of not there. So somehow, someplace, I mean, one of the listeners sent in a thing the other day, what's going to be the difference between a Trump or Biden, now Harris or whoever else, presidency. Dan, if you and I live in two houses next to each other, we both got the wives, and all of a sudden we're deep in hack, and we're spending a lot more than we're. I don't know what our leanings in terms of party, our political party. The numbers are the numbers. I mean, I don't care who it is, whether it. whether it's Trump or Harris, come up with some Houdini BS. Fact is, somehow, someplace, they either got to get some more revenue, meaning taxes, or yeah, they got to start cutting some costs, some stuff, because guess what? And the hole there where they probably could do all the cutting, and that in terms of health, in terms of how much they pay, is in Medicare and Medicaid and in prescription drugs, and nobody has any stones to go after those people. They've got everybody bought and paid for. So I don't know what corner they're in, but it's a bad corner they've painted themselves in. It doesn't matter who
gets
in.
And how do they
get
out of it?
Yeah.
I think, how do they get out of that corner, I think is a good question.
So, don't tell it. The question is, why are we so sure that if this curve normalizes, that the front rates are going down and not the back rates going up? If that happens, now we got a real problem. The market and Fed
across the board, yeah. And you've been kind of on this kick for quite a while now that we're thinking that rates are going to go higher, and there's no reason that couldn't happen. So I tend to agree with you. I think some of it has to do on the, in the near term, just part of the reason it's working is because we've seen a gradual slowdown rather than a sharp slowdown, and a gradual slowdown or a soft landing, as they're calling it, is actually a good thing. It's a good thing to have everything adjust over time. So that's sort of the good news. I'm not sure the market is paying too close attention to, it's really interesting that I don't think they're paying too close attention to the election, and because there is, fortunately or thankfully, we're not immune from it, but we're somewhat doing our own thing. So that's a good news. But there, as you're saying, them being backed into the corner in terms of how they're going to deal with the deficit, absolutely no question. I think on both sides, there are challenges for the policies that they're bringing forth or that they're discussing. So I'm not sure that there's a solution on either side, but I do agree with you. That's like ticking in the background. And it's something that, because this has been an election year that has really taken back seat, back burner, it's not been discussed. It's, very seldom do you hear, oh, here's how I'm going to deal with it. Yeah, I mean, cutting, you don't want to tell people in our age group that they're going to cut Medicare and Social Security. We paid into it, so there's no reason that should happen. But there are probably other areas that where there could be some changes made. I think maybe changing, like having sort of a new financial plan, if you will, for the country would be equally as important. And that is going to take time. So in the meantime, yeah, rates could go higher. We could get a positive yield curve by the longer end going higher. But the other reason that would happen is if there was less conviction by global markets on our economy. So if there was one of the reasons that rates stay low is because foreign investors still see us as the safe haven. So if that for some reason changes and we don't have that, or we lose some of that position with the rest of the world, then we could see rates go higher.
Well, I mean, I just, when you go out for more money, and it seems you're going to end up, if all of a sudden, Chinese aren't doing so well,
right,
if they keep dropping their amount of money they come over here and invest, we have to be made up someplace. Now, it's being made up other places so far, and it's being made up domestically. But in order, again, in the world of not much in the way of interest rates, nobody even thinks this way anymore. Well, how do I get more money? It's like anything else. You're going to pay more for the money. Well, how do I do that? Well, the interest rates go higher. I mean, there seems to be, with all the governmental policies in the last 10 years, one of the things that seems like it's totally missed is people's understanding of, I'll say, traditionally basic economics, because they've knocked the basic economics off the drawing board. See, I give my money to a bank and they give me nothing for it. Well, yeah. Oh, okay then. Why would I do that necessarily?
I absolutely agree with you. I almost think everyone needs a refresher course on macroeconomics and how all these factors interrelate and what does determine rates, interest rates, and just things that are very, very basic. I think that it'd be nice to have some sort of education, sort of update on that I think will provide.
I wish you were with us last Friday, sitting over at Ceres, because I could have used you. I had, One guy who's a kind of a big shot at Oak CC, another guy runs from these big firms, and we started talking about short stack and short stack interest. I'm like giving a class. And this is 30 year old stuff, but if there's interest rates, one guy says, "Well, what's short stack?" And the guy goes, "Well, you got to pay for that." And I go, "No." You know, normally you don't pay; they pay you.
Right, they pay you. Right.
I mean, how does that happen? Because now the only people who want short stack, and we got to go, but the only people who want short stack are trying to get something in a stack that's hard to borrow, which you might end up paying for. But that isn't the normal situation.
Right.
It's anyway. Dan, good stuff. I'm glad. Oh, how was your trip? Just give me a quick one. Yes or no?
Trip was great. Got to do some boating, biking, mountain biking, hiking. A perfect getaway.
You're not one of the guys who, when it was going to be 130 degrees in Death Valley, and they said, go at your own risk. And by the way, the helicopters can't even fly, or we're not going to fly them.
The
biker definitely. Gang that tried to go across, and the two bikes conked out, and one of the guys croaked.
Nah, jeez.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
We can do it. Oops. Anyway, have a good week. Hopefully see you soon. SP Futures up a buck. NASDAQ Futures up 17. We were down. Now we're up. We'll see if we stay up. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.